You are listening to The Vitals, a bi-monthly podcast for all things oncology nursing. For even more content, check out oncologynursingnews.com or find Oncology Nursing News on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or LinkedIn. Hi everyone, this is Lindsay Fisher, Associate Editor at Oncology Nursing News. In this episode of The Vitals, a panel of oncology nurses and nurse practitioners with backgrounds in gastric and breast cancer unpack adverse event management with antibody drug conjugates. Sarah Donahue of the University of California, San Francisco Health, Jamie Carroll of the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota, Teresa Gillespie of the Winship Cancer Institute with Emory University, and Elizabeth Prechtel-Dumphy of the Abramson Cancer Center in Philadelphia recently met for a peer exchange to discuss best nursing practices with approved antibody drug conjugates. Following a case study presented by Gillespie regarding a woman with metastatic gastric cancer who develops neutropenia while receiving trastuzumab deruxtecan, the colleagues delve into a conversation surrounding the potential AEs associated with this treatment, including neutropenia, neuropathy, nausea, and interstitial lung disease. They compare the rate of incidence for these AEs between gastric and breast cancers, pose questions regarding the value of interdisciplinary collaboration with pulmonary teams, and pitch questions regarding agent suitability for patients with pre-existing comorbidities. Basing their conversation around published clinical trial data and experience from their personal practice, they discuss how to best manage these events, wrapping up with clinical pearls for all oncology nurses who care for patients receiving an ADC for metastatic disease.
I'm Sarah Donahue. I'm a nurse practitioner at UC California, San Francisco. I'm joined today by a panel of colleagues who treat breast cancer and gastric cancer, and I would like to welcome them all.
Welcome. My name is Jamie Carroll. I'm a nurse practitioner. I specialize in breast cancer, and I work at Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota.
Hi, my name is Liz Prechtel-Dunphy. I'm a GI oncology nurse practitioner at the Abramson Cancer Center in Philadelphia. In addition to my clinical role, I am also faculty at the School of Nursing in the Oncology Minor Postmaster Certificate Program.
Hi, I'm Teresa Gillespie. I'm an oncology nurse and a professor in the Emory University School of Medicine and in the Winship Cancer Institute. So this is a 70-year-old Caucasian female, and her presenting symptoms were just some really not very profound nausea and diarrhea. However, she did have an unexplained weight loss of 13 pounds. Interestingly, she had no family history of other GI cancers. She's never smoked. She didn't have any dietary risk factors, such as consuming a lot of smoked or preserved meats, which are often associated with gastric cancer. And she had no other comorbidities except for osteoporosis, and she had been treated for that. So with her symptoms, her primary care provider referred her to a gastroenterologist. And she had a colonoscopy, which was negative, and then she had an EGD, which did show a gastric lesion. And then she was further worked up, including a biopsy, which showed gastric adenocarcinoma. So she was then referred to an oncologist who recommended systemic therapy with fluorouracil, leucovorin, oxaliplatin, and docetaxel, which is considered category one evidence. So she got four cycles of neoadjuvant, four cycles of adjuvant chemotherapy, and really tolerated her systemic therapy quite well. She had surgery in between there, which included a subtotal gastrectomy with lymphadenectomy. So on pathology, her tumor was classified as T3 and 0M1, which is a stage 2A. The margins were clear, and she did have HER2 overexpression. The patient, needless to say, was quite excited, thought that, you know, everything was pretty much taken care of. And the next steps were really to be followed regularly by her oncologist and her surgeon. However, 14 months after her surgery, she began to experience some shortness of breath. And so she had a diagnostic workup and the biopsy, which showed that she had metastatic disease in her left lung. She had some other testing that was done. And based on all of these findings, she was started on a trastuzumab pembro regimen that was given every 3 weeks and She really tolerated that chemotherapy well as well. However, after two cycles, her lung disease showed progression. And so at that point, she was referred to an NCI Cancer Center for consideration of further treatment. There was considerable discussion about treatment options, as well as a thorough assessment of the patient, her comorbidities, previous therapies, et cetera. But her performance status was really excellent. She was doing very well. And so she elected to begin second-line treatment with T-DXd at 6.4 milligrams per kilogram every 3 weeks. And she had a CBC that was repeated prior to each dose. So unfortunately, she developed neutropenia, which is not uncommon. And in fact, myelosuppression is one of the most common toxicities that are reported with this drug. She did have a grade 3 neutropenia, as well as an elevated temp. So the treatment was stopped, and she was assessed for other signs and sources of infection, including ILD and pneumonitis. However, those findings were negative. So she was started on antibiotics in the clinic and evaluated for outpatient treatment. Her status was confirmed to be low risk, so she was discharged to home with her family members and scheduled for follow-up care. Her fever also resolved very quickly, and there was no evidence or documentation of infection that was found. So we continued to monitor her, and after 3 weeks of follow-up, her ANC recovered to a grade 0 status. And then we restarted her drug at a one dose reduction. So she went from 6.4 milligrams per kilogram to 5.4. And the plan was to maintain this dose level for her next cycles unless she required a subsequent dose reduction, or if her disease progressed further, at which time we would need to think about other options. So since that point, she's continued to tolerate her current regimen, and she's actually had very good marked response to treatment with the drug. And in terms of just tolerating the therapy, she's done quite well considering everything she's been through in particular.
How common is neutropenia in patients with gastric cancer receiving T-DXd, Teresa, and which patients are at risk? Are you more worried about?
Right. So as I mentioned, myelosuppression across the board is rather common. In the DESTINY-Gastric01 trial, which was the one that was done in Asia, those patients had really high rates of neutropenia, around 70-71% of all grades and about 58% of grade 3. So that's pretty significant. And close to 5% actually had febrile neutropenia. In subsequent studies, those numbers are less, and we don't see quite that many in our own practice. But there are some risk factors that we do need to keep in mind. And when we talk about gastric cancer, these definitely tend to apply. So one factor would be age. And as I mentioned previously, in gastric cancer, most of these patients are older patients. So you don't see a lot of 40-year-olds with gastric cancer. So age is already kind of a risk factor overall with gastric cancer. The kinds of cancer that they're having, and gastric is also associated with it, as well as previous therapies that they might have had that, you know, perhaps that left their bone marrow a little beat up from previous regimens. But the other things are comorbidities. And so there's lots of comorbid conditions, including obesity, diabetes, congestive heart failure, COPD, rheumatoid or osteoarthritis, as well as HIV. So all of those are considered risk factors to neutropenia. And so it's like other systemic therapies that also have risk of neutropenia, and you want to make sure you're educating the patients. And of course, we're monitoring their CBC and ANC regularly.
Yeah, I mean, to add what Teresa was saying, in breast cancer, just over 40 patients have any grade neutropenia with T-DXd or trastuzumab deruxtecan. I would agree that many patients are at risk, including what Teresa was saying. And then in addition, I think patients that have known bone marrow involvement, they're at increased risk for neutropenia or myelosuppression from treatment.
So they might be the patients that you're getting your white blood cell, your GCSF ordered for. And in this case, since this medication is given once every 3 weeks, you could consider something longer acting even. What choice are you guys using for your white blood cell support as far as what sort of treatment do you usually use?
That's a little bit physician choice. So I can't say we have a strict policy on that. And we don't usually see a lot of patients that do have marrow involvement with gastric cancer. Liz may in her own practice, but that's not something that we normally would see a lot.
We haven't seen a terrible amount of this either in our practice. And we haven't had the incidents where we have had to use a growth factor support, but I imagine if that were to be the case, again, as Teresa said, it's physician choice. I would think that they would use a long-acting growth support factor, but we haven't had that incident yet.
Are there any parameters that are considered in a patient with metastatic gastric cancer started on trastuzumab deruxtecan to reduce the risk of neutropenia? Is there anything that we can do sort of prior to prevent it?
So I don't know that there's anything we can do prior to prevent it, except that we have good monitoring. We consider those risk factors that Teresa mentioned when we're looking at our patients, how heavily pretreated they are. So maybe getting a sense of how compromised their bone marrow is and just keeping those facts in mind when you're prescribing this for a patient, and the education comes in with not only the patient, but their caregiver to make sure that they know when to call the provider should they start feeling well or they develop a temperature or other signs and symptoms of infection.
And just to sort of piggyback on what Jamie said earlier about, you know, patients may be reluctant to report certain symptoms. The good, I guess you could say the good thing about neutropenia is that there's a lab test. So it's not like they can pretend that, oh, I don't have an ANC of 600 or whatever. But they do have to be educated and have it reinforced in terms of if they develop a fever or any other signs or symptoms of an infection. And as I mentioned, these patients, they can be quite ill. And so they may have a lot going on with them. And something that could be very much honed in on, if you don't have a lot of other symptoms that you're dealing with, that may be even overlooked when you're dealing with some of the problems that our gastric patients have. So just think about some of the surgeries that they have and the nutritional consequences of that, trying to get enough nutrition in, particularly if they've had significant surgery or a total gastrectomy, for example. And so, you know, a lot of times their focus is on those kind of day-to-day, how many calories can I get in a day, or how am I going to be feeling in quality of life? So you have to really make sure you're reinforcing every time, maybe a little broken record, but to make sure they're hearing that and their caregivers and family members are hearing that too. And we try to emphasize, this is not something we mess around with. This is something that is really, really important that you report that and report it at the earliest time that it's observed.
Are you seeing patients like similar on docetaxel carboplatin regimens or on your doxorubicin cyclophosphamide regimens where when they become neutropenic, they're having oral sores on trastuzumab deruxtecan? I haven't had that experience with this medication in breast patients myself. So just curious.
No, that's not been a prominent problem, Liz.
No, it hasn't in our practice either.
And for breast patients on trastuzumab deruxtecan, I think that we counsel patients similarly. Jamie, do you agree as far as neutropenia goes?
Yeah, I agree. I also think that this is one area where COVID has helped, right? Because prior to COVID, if somebody was wearing a mask out in public, then everyone would kind of look at them. But now that's a common thing. So if you are neutropenic and we're worried about, you know, development of neutropenic fever or dose delays, holds, anything like that, patients can wear a mask out in public. I really counsel them, don't kiss or hug somebody with a known infection. And then if you're going to be inside in a crowded area, it might not be a bad idea to wear a mask. I am really all about quality of life, though. So when patients ask me about neutropenia and we know that they're going to be neutropenic maybe cycle or day 7 through 11 in a cycle, they say, should I stay home? Should I not go anywhere? And for me, it's really about quality of life. I don't want them to be fearful of living their life. They have a metastatic diagnosis. And although we hope for metastatic breast cancer that they're alive for several years, I don't want those years to be low quality of years because they're fearful of leaving their home because of a development of infection or because they're neutropenic. So I really try to strive for them to go out and do the things that bring them joy, the things that they like to do. And so that's part of what I counsel when we're discussing side effects of treatment.
Yeah, I think we all have patients like that for sure. So the common adverse events associated with trastuzumab deruxtecan for breast cancer patients, at least, I can tell you, is nausea. We have a lot of nausea, so we give them a lot of premedications. We include our aprepitant type premedication along with a long-acting 5-HT3 inhibitor. I give dexamethasone as a premedication, and I also make sure that they have take-home medications such as ondansetron, lorazepam, and prochlorperazine. Sometimes I'm adding even on olanzapine for patients that are having a lot of nausea, and often omeprazole or something like that for that, the acid reflux that happens. I'm not seeing as much diarrhea as they may have seen in the trials. Personally, I'm not seeing a lot of it, but we are making sure that they have Imodium on hand at home. So the main side effect to me is, most common main side effect is that nausea. I have patients with fatigue. The hair loss is minimal, although I have had like 1 in 10 patients lose a lot of hair with patchy loss of hair. So it's not 100% that it's just going to be hair thinning. And then finally, we have these interstitial lung disease or pneumonitis that can occur, that I'm not seeing it that often, but we are, because they're metastatic, getting CT scans all the time. So we're luckily finding asymptomatic ILD and pneumonitis and able to treat them appropriately with prednisone early. Are other people in the gastric cancer world experiencing different side effects with their patients, or is it similar?
So I can just address that. So just looking at both practical experience, but particularly the data from the trials that we've had, which admittedly the number of patients on the first two published gastric trials have been fairly small, you do see interstitial lung disease as well as pneumonitis. But I think the thing that is more profound and of concern is neutropenia. You also see common side effects, as you mentioned, for breast, such as nausea, vomiting, fatigue, things like that. But actually in the Gastric 01 trial, the rates of neutropenia were about 72%, with considerable number having grade 3 or 4. And actually, there's about a 5% rate for febrile neutropenia. So, you know, those are areas that we would definitely want to kind of focus on.
Yeah, I think the dose is a little different in gastric cancer versus breast cancer. So that could be the reason why you guys are noticing a little bit more neutropenia. I've seen neutropenia, but not febrile neutropenia with trastuzumab deruxtecan. What is your all experience with increased AST and ALT? I find that we're having to really closely monitor and hold or dose reduce based on their increase in liver enzymes.
I have not had increased liver enzymes in any of my patients that I can think of to date right now. Has anybody else? And that's been happening in several of your patients?
I see it frequently. 6.4 versus 5.4.
Yeah, some.
And are you seeing with the gastric cancers that you're having to give them a pegfilgrastim sort of right off the bat, or are you seeing how they do and then adding in, filgrastim, like the short acting daily dosing as needed?
So in our practice, we don't do that prophylactically. We would monitor the patient during the course of therapy. If it were to occur, we would delay treatment and then consider maybe a dose reduction before adding the growth factor support. At least that's what our practice is at this time.
Are there any other adverse events? Are you guys seeing hair loss like I'm seeing, where about 1 in 10 are really, really losing quite a bit of hair? I don't often offer patients our cold capping that we have here. I don't know what you have at your institutions, but we don't offer that to them as of now. But I've definitely started thinking maybe we should. I've also had a few patients that have had some thrombocytopenia, just one or two. Are you seeing that in the gastric cancer dosing at all? Or is it mostly neutropenia?
I would say neutropenia is more prevalent, but I'd say myelosuppression across the board, including anemia. So, you know, it sort of hits all the bases.
I think it was reassuring to know that the updated safety profile did not show prolonged side effects. And in fact, GI side effects are decreased over time, in addition to the alopecia improves.
That is good to know. So how common is this risk of this interstitial lung disease? Do we know the percentages? I think that the earlier trials showed that it was higher. It initially, when we started giving trastuzumab deruxtecan, I felt really anxious about interstitial lung disease and pneumonitis. I was wanting to, at any sort of like whisper of shortness of breath or a cough, I was ordering CT chest immediately. I was even with some patients having them do their scans in breast every 2 months rather than every three, which is, I don't know how often you're scanning people in gastric cancer, but it was really making me nervous. But the more recent data has showed that it's less common than we thought, or it's less detrimental, meaning like the sequela are less because it maybe perhaps it's being treated sooner with steroids. I'm not sure.
Well, I think one of the interesting things about gastric cancer and the trials that they've done, so that the initial trial, Destiny Gastric 01, was actually done in Japan and Korea. And we know that globally, gastric cancer is not rare. It's I think it's number five in terms of incidence and number four in terms of mortality. And it's particularly prevalent among East Asia. So they had a 10% rate of interstitial lung disease and pneumonitis in that population, particularly at the Japan site. So that was not repeated, or that was not seen again when they went to Western populations in Europe and the US. So there may be something very distinct about that population, but fortunately that has not been seen, at least in the trials that have been done. Of course, we have several that are ongoing at this time.
Yeah, even though we're not seeing the percentages that we initially were fearful of, I still counsel my patients about letting us know if there's any shortness of breath, any exertional dyspnea, if you have got any chest pain, any tightness, please let us know. I think a lot of times patients are afraid to tell us about symptoms because they know that we're the gatekeepers for their treatment and they just don't want to let us know, or they might brush it off, right? They might say, I got a little shortness of breath, but I walked up some stairs. And so they don't tell us. So I think it's really important to, when we're giving these treatments to our patients, that we're giving them the education and letting them know that they have to tell us when they develop new symptoms, either through the portal or let us know when they come in for treatment.
I think that's all really excellent and applicable. The problem that, and you'll hear this in the case that I'm presenting, is when you have someone with metastatic disease to the lungs, they already have respiratory symptoms. And so then you get into issues of, you know, well, this is just the cough that I already had, or this is the respiratory symptom that I already had. And so it does cause a great deal of anxiety when patients do have other pulmonary symptoms, or, you know, already are at risk for the more serious adverse events. So there's a lot of back and forth, a lot of patient education, as you mentioned, and hopefully you can stay on top of that.
Are you finding that you're getting pulmonary involved often in your patients to help sort of differentiate what's going on in their lungs from metastases to interstitial lung disease?
Liz, I don't know if you wanted to address that as well. We absolutely get pulmonary consultation in very early. And of course, if they already have lung mets, they're probably already involved.
Yeah, no, I agree. We initially will get some imaging there on our, when we see the patients initially, but then getting the pulmonary team on board is critical. And I think just to add on to the comments before, trying to make your assessments seem not as scary to the patient. You know, when you're doing your review of systems with them, to just continue to ask about their breathing, their cough, dyspnea, makes it less scary so that if they were to answer yes to the question, they wouldn't be afraid to report that. So doing that on a consistent basis, I think, helps the communication with the patient and also the patient reporting.
Just sort of normalize it. So the package insert for trastuzumab deruxtecan says that if a patient has symptomatic ILD, you are supposed to discontinue the medication altogether. Are you finding that you're doing that in your practice? I don't know if you've had very many patients to, as an example for this, but, or are you sort of deciding based on how severe the symptoms are?
Thankfully, I haven't had any patients that have developed interstitial lung disease on this medication. So I haven't had to discontinue due to that, thankfully.
And thinking of a patient we just saw this week, he is asymptomatic, but had some changes on his chest imaging. So we're being very cautious with monitoring. We haven't had to move forward with holding treatment or making adjustments or intervening right at this point, but we're monitoring very closely and checking in on him on the weeks off of treatment just to make sure that nothing's changed.
We also have not had any patients actually have documented, but likely we would follow the safety precautions.
We haven't had anybody with symptomatic ILD. That's more than just a slight shortness of breath, I suppose. So I would probably say we haven't had anybody with symptomatic ILD, and we have been able to continue the treatment once they're on their steroids and they're able to taper down a little bit. Timing of when to restart is always questionable, but as long as they're feeling better and their first scan is, we'll do a CT chest maybe a few weeks later to make sure that it's on the going in the right direction before we restart. So before we close, I would like to ask each one of you to share some pearls for your fellow nurses regarding toxicity management and ADCs in patients with metastatic breast cancer and gastric cancer.
So for breast cancer, if there's any risk of stomatitis, peripheral neuropathy, just think freeze. Freeze everything. Have them chew ice in the chemotherapy unit. Have them stick their hands and their feet in elastogel mittens and booties. If you're worried about alopecia, cryotherapy to the head. So just think ice is never wrong. And then additionally, I do see where patients have dryness of the mouth and mucosal membranes. So recommend actually Xylomelt. It's a little disc they can put down under their cheek at night, and it helps stimulate the salivary gland. Or you can go buy a $2 bag of Jolly Ranchers. And if you suck on those, that helps stimulate the salivary glands to help with their dry mouth.
What I would suggest is doing a very good initial assessment when you're meeting, whether you're meeting the patient for the first time or you're seeing them in follow-up. But I think in particular, before they start treatment, to just know where they are at baseline. So having that information prior to seeing the patient as they start treatment gives me good information. And secondly, I always like to, if I can, involve the caregiver, because they are always the tattletale in the room and the patients don't always like that. But I think it's good to sort of have someone who is in real time with the patient from day to day, being able to give their perspective. Obviously, they can't tell you what the patient's feeling, but they can at least tell you what they're observing, which gives some added input to help you make decisions for the patient.
So I would say I have 2 points maybe I'd like to share or just reinforce. And the first is tagging a little bit from what Liz said about a baseline assessment. For me, it would be to really be able to do a thorough and careful assessment in terms of what might be a toxicity or some kind of sign or symptom that the patient is experiencing, trying to figure out for real, is this the drug? Is this the cancer? Is this the therapy? Because that's all too often perhaps easy to mix up, and therefore that would influence the best intervention. But the second point is just to remember that regardless of whatever the drug is, these patients have metastatic disease. And part and parcel with that is high anxiety. And so every single twinge or any symptom that they're experiencing to them has to represent that this is progression of disease. This is another site of metastases. So it influences and colors all of our interactions. And so whatever you as the provider can do to help both the patient and the caregiver or family member to just sort of recognize that, yes, this is metastatic disease, but something I said earlier about looking at it more as a marathon rather than a sprint. Because if you do look at those second and third and fifth line options, in many cases, there's lots and lots on the menu. And that's not a panacea. It's just something that hopefully can be helpful.
Thanks, Teresa. For me, it would be for a pearl to share when I have patients that are going to be on a regimen that's highly immunogenic. I, of course, want to prevent as much as possible. So I make sure that I have, like for trastuzumab deruxtecan, we've had a lot of issues with nausea. So I make sure that they have a lot of pre-meds and a aprepitant and the 5-HT3 inhibitor and the dexamethasone and whatever else I can add in there. But also I have been prescribing patients often olanzapine. It was shown to be effective for patients getting doxorubicin and cyclophosphamide, the early stage regimens that we use for breast cancer. And it was shown to really reduce and prevent nausea if they took it just for the first 5 nights. So I've actually used that with trastuzumab deruxtecan quite a bit. So I would recommend that to anybody. And then also, I do totally agree, Teresa, that everything is in the details with patients, like understanding what they're experiencing every day and every moment of that day and what they're taking to deal with it and how they manage that helps you figure out what the cause is and how to treat it. And so asking a lot of questions, I always think I drive my patients crazy, but asking more questions is always better.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Vitals. Be sure to never miss a beat with Oncology Nursing News.